Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop.
I was told by a lot of people that I was gonna get a job right out of college, and then all of a sudden, there's no jobs.
College graduates looking for work in a tight labor market.
They're struggling. They're living back at home with their parents. They're spending down their savings.
If I go for something like Walmart or McDonald's, or which is the type of jobs there is around here right now, I just wasted all that time in my life for nothing.
Today on the show, we look at why college-educated people are filling up the unemployment line. We'll get the expert view on this. And don't forget, stick around after that for a breakdown of the latest local news in and around Chicago. But first, senior producer Meha Ahmed is here with me. Hey, Meha.
Hey, Sasha.
So, Meha, this story, I don't know, it surprised me. I think maybe worried me because I am from that old school line of thinking where if you go out and you get yourself a college degree, you can have yourself a really successful career.
Yeah, I think it worried both of us.
Yeah.
I definitely was worried. I saw this story. We all saw the story in the New York Times about how, you know, college-educated people are suffering more and more from long-term unemployment. This comes from research from UChicago's Booth School of Business. And, yeah, I mean, we're all told that if you have a degree, we've been told for decades, like, if you want a good job and a good salary,
right,
you need to have a college degree to make that American dream come true. And where it looks like it's less and less.
That's
true.
Changing.
That wisdom is changing a bit.
That's changing for sure. And so I think from this conversation, what was interesting is that our expert guests do go into the reasons why. We talk about what's driving the trend. But I feel like they leave us with a bit of optimism toward the end.
Yeah, I mean, they did say that it's not a hopeless cause, you know, but that college graduates, whether it's you're a recent college graduate or you've been out of college for a while, just had to think more strategic about their skill sets,
mm-hmm,
what they wanted to do in the future, and to not get locked in on one kind of job.
Yeah, key word in this conversation, transferable skills.
Transferable skills. Yeah, you're going to learn a lot about that.
Think about those skills that you can do in this job and potentially the next.
Yeah, so this was a really interesting conversation, and I recommend everybody, you know, listen very closely to it. But also, if this sounds like you really relate to the fact that you have a college degree and you've been stuck in unemployment for a while, we want to hear from you. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-915-9945. Again, that's 888-915-9945.
I'd be interested to see who gives us a call. I'd love to hear their stories.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Meha.
No problem.
Table, Noam Scheiber. He's a Chicago-based reporter for the New York Times, focusing on white-collar workers. His forthcoming book, Mutiny, The Rise and Revolt of the College-Educated Working Class, is out next April. And Brian Thompson, who's a clinical professor of economics at DePaul University. Noam and Brian will help us understand the ins and outs of the job market for people with college degrees. But first, Noam started us off by helping us understand just what long-term unemployment is.
It's generally 27 weeks or longer, so longer than 6 months. And that rate, as a portion of the overall job market, is still pretty low. But it's been rising and rising at a rate that is unusual for a period when we're not in a recession. So
mm-hmm.
It's not surprising during the financial crisis in 2008 that the long-term unemployment rate really shot up. But in the last few years, the economy's been pretty strong.
Yeah.
Overall unemployment rate's been pretty low. And yet we have this rising rate of long-term unemployed, and within that, a rising portion who are college graduates. So a lot of economists are sort of scratching their head
mm-hmm.
over what's going on and whether there's some kind of deeper tectonic plate shifting that's going on here.
Even though it feels like a sign of the times, as you alluded to, like everybody's struggling, right? You look left, you look right to your neighbors. It's been a tough time for just a lot of people across the board, no matter your educational background.
It has, no question. What we've seen over the past 10 years or so is that if you compare college-educated folks to non-college folks, the non-college folks have tend to do better in relative terms. Their wages have grown faster.
Mm-hmm.
traditionally college educated workers earn a so-called premium. You know, their wages tend to be higher on average, but that premium has sort of stalled out in the end, toward the end of the 2010s, and even started to shrink a bit. So it does start to raise some questions about, as you say, about the value of a college degree, particularly mm-hmm. since we all know that college isn't free.
It's not.
End up leaving college with a lot of debt. And so if that's still not the same investment that it was 20, 30 years ago, it starts to raise questions about how useful it is.
Before we get the professor in here, I mean, I'm curious how we're tracking this and whether that's hard to do, because you've got specific stats here in your piece for the Times that talks about how those who are unemployed for more than 6 months, how that number rose to its highest share in over 3 years to nearly 26%.
Yeah. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which has been in the news a lot over the past few months, it produces pretty detailed data on this. So they produce both the overall unemployment rate, the long-term unemployment rate, and then the portion of unemployed people. So all the people who are unemployed, what portion of those people have been unemployed for longer than 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that shot up to around 26% in the last month for which we have data. And that, again, is very unusual for a non-recession period to have the long-term unemployed be that high a portion of the overall unemployed.
So, Professor Thompson, I mean, you know, researchers at UChicago as well are seeing that college-educated people are making up a larger amount of the unemployment pool. Any surprises for you?
It's interesting. Like, when I think about this, I teach strategy in the economic space. And so strategy is about how you adjust to the environment. And the environment's changing. And I think that from an economic perspective, you start to think about reference point adaption. And, like, you know, the reference point is, like, what a degree used to mean a certain job. And
mm-hmm.
I think that change is happening, and I think that it requires an update. And
yeah.
the faster you adapt to that change, the more likely that I think you'll find employment.
As I was talking to a producer yesterday, and I was saying, you know, when I think back, no employer's ever asked me to show them my degree. I'm like, I could just be out here making things up. I'm not. But my point being, I mean, what is really the value here?
Absolutely. And that value, like the value proposition is changing, and our offerings as universities is changing as well. And I like to think about it as a holistic, personal and professional development journey. And that really, it adds confidence, it adds tools and specific skills. And that process is becoming more experiential. And that is really, a different value proposition than it has been historically.
Right.
And I think that's really, something that we are focused on.
So the big question, what are some of the factors driving this trend, Noam? For starters, you report on the fact that more college grads, we've got more of them than we did, say, 10 years ago. That's one piece. The job market today also looks better for people who don't have degrees. What else is causing this?
Yeah, I think there's a general sense, though the specific cause remains a little bit of a mystery, but there's a general sense that automation has started to cut against college grads over the past 10, 20 years. You know, we're used to thinking of automation hurting blue-collar folks. If we automate, factories, then we need fewer blue-collar workers in factories.
Mm-hmm.
And for decades and decades, the solution to this was more training, more skills, even going to college. But what we've seen in the past 10, 20 years is that some of that automation trend has started to cut against white-collar workers. You know, we think of AI, when we think of AI, we think of ChatGPT and this sort of explosion of chatbots and
yes.
and very sophisticated models.
I was going to ask you
models.
How AI plays into this.
So AI is definitely a piece, but there are actually important developments in AI years before ChatGPT. I actually wrote a story in 2016 or 2017 about how companies were using AI to predict fashion trends. So we used to have all these buyers that at big retail companies, companies that sell you clothes, and they used to have buyers whose job it was to just kind of go out, go to the wholesalers, go to the designers, and try to figure out what would be popular in the next season. But now we have a huge amount of data about that and algorithms that are very good at predicting that. And
right.
so you find that retailers were employing fewer buyers, which was a pretty good paying job. You know, people would make well into the six figures for doing that job. But starting around 10 years ago, they started leaning more on algorithms to do that than humans. And so this trend that feels very recent with the explosion of ChatGPT and chatbots has actually been, 10,
it's
15 years in the making.
For yep. a while. How else have you seen, Professor, AI sort of impact the labor force?
Sure. I mean, on the one side, like I think, again, back to education, I think that, you know, you can take different perspectives. You can fight against it, or you can, you know, recognize it's an excellent tool for in enhancing your productivity and enhancing the way you think. And that's really, you know, like how we're integrating into the education now is that we're not fighting against it. We're actually adding it as a tool, and we're adding it to the skill set of students so that they are better prepared for the jobs of today and tomorrow.
So, Noam, you also point to Trump's cuts to federal workers and funding. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the federal government and nonprofits and universities employ a disproportionate share of college-educated workers. So you're, if you look across the whole workforce, the portion of those folks who are college-educated, and you look just at the federal government and universities and nonprofits, much higher share in that latter sector. So obviously when President Trump cut funding to universities, cut off government funding for certain nonprofits like biomedical research institutions, and just cut workers from the federal government, that hit college-educated workers harder than it hit people without a degree. And so you already had this kind of longer-term weakening that was playing out over the course of the previous decade. And then you added on top of that a tougher job market for the kinds of scientists who are working in government or working at universities, lawyers who are working in the federal government, all kinds of research analysts, economists. The Federal Reserve just stopped hiring economists in January when the president announced some of his cuts. So you took a situation that was already getting a little weaker for college grads and you threw this kind of shock on top of it.
Across several industries.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You also write that, quote, college-educated people may also be prone to excessive optimism and slow to realize that some of their traditional jobs are vanishing. So optimism's a bad thing now, Professor? What do you think?
Well, I think that really points to the reference point adaption, like that adapting to the new reality of, you know, I had this job before, it'll come around. It may not be coming around. You may need to adapt to a different opportunity that is now more in demand.
I think a lot of people are still putting so much power into that piece of paper, that degree.
Yeah, I think so. And when you think of what a lot of college-educated folks have and what they think they bring to the job market is a kind of a very specific and sophisticated set of skills. And if you have a pretty sophisticated set of skills, those are often targeted at a kind of niche in the labor market. So you're a certain type of engineer or you're a certain type of lawyer. And when those jobs disappear, because your skills are so specific to that niche, it may take you longer to adjust than if you had a kind of broader, more general set of skills. So I think we're seeing that with college grads who had worked in these niches. They were very well compensated in these niches. But as these niches sort of erode, you start to scramble.
They have to pivot too, right? Some of them are literally having to look for jobs outside their field.
Absolutely. No question.
So I want to also talk about the psychological and financial toll of being without a job for a long period of time, right? What did you find? You surveyed some folks in your piece. What did they say?
Yeah, so we put out a call out on the New York Times website inviting readers who had been in this position to share their experiences with us. We got over 250 responses, so a pretty good response. And I would say the overwhelming through line through these responses was anxiety, just an enormous amount of anxiety, people struggling with depression. And I think there was a sense that while everybody who is unemployed for longer than 6 months, whether you have a college degree or you don't, this can be an incredibly traumatic experience for you, one from which it could take you years to recover. I think the thing that was distinctive about college-educated folks is they felt like they had done all these things. They had jumped through these hoops. Mm-hmm. They had, you know, gotten the credential. They had done everything that they were told to do. So they had this set of expectations about what would result from that. And then the gap between their expectations, having jumped through all these hoops their entire life, and then their reality was very wide. And that was that gap was just such a punch in the face, I think, to so many people.
If you're just tuning in, we're digging into why so many college grads are part of the long-term unemployed. Professor Thompson, I mean, what are economists forecasting here?
I mean, if you look at the data, the expectation that the trend somewhat continues, I don't think that is, can be debated. I think
so. It continues, but is it going to get worse?
I think that external factors are probably influence how, you know, like the degree to which there's change, like the economy and so forth. I think that would probably be the leading factor on that. But I always point back to the importance of like individual, like, you know, like the individual's role. I think that's, you know, is Noam pointed out about the anxiety, like, you know, like expecting that the market's going to make the change for you is probably a bad strategy. Like thinking about like your role in it, I think is really important, and like what you can do in terms of making changes.
Mm-hmm. You talked, Noam, about people having, you know, very specialized niche skills. Transferable skills are something, you know, that it's not often right there in your face. Sometimes when you get into a specific field, like, I mean, I'm in the field of journalism. I don't think right off the bat about all of the things that I can take from this into another career, because you're thinking, this is the career I've invested in. This is where I'm going to stay. But are there transferable skills that people who are long-term unemployed can draw from to market themselves in a new way?
Yeah, well, the value proposition for college had long been, it will teach you how to think. It will teach you how to analyze. It will teach you how to assess evidence. It will teach you how to communicate clearly, how to write. I think many of those things are probably still marketable skills, though there is, as Brian was saying, some adjustment that needs to happen in a world where a chatbot can write an essay that looks as good or better than that of the average college
grad. Insane that we are here. You know, I think about my kid. I just sent one off to college a few weeks ago, and she picked a major. She chose to go into marketing, right? And she'll specialize later into sort of what type of marketing, but I remember at 18, her saying to me, or 17 actually, when she was applying, her saying to me, well, you know, I'm doing this because that means I can work for anyone. She's like, I can work for Revlon. I can work for, you know, a food organization. I can work in the music industry. She was already thinking about, I guess, transferable skills. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the value proposition of a liberal arts education or a broad education in college was that it makes you very well rounded, makes you generally able to communicate well and really hones your analytical skills. I think the concern is, as we have these AI platforms that are increasingly sophisticated at doing this stuff, is sort of where does the human fit into that picture? I'm somewhat optimistic. I think we'll figure it out, but there may be an adjustment period of 5 or 10 or 15 years where we're all sort of scrambling a bit to see how we do that.
Yeah, so as we wrap, can you both sort of leave us with something that college grads should maybe keep in mind right now about the job market? You first, Noam.
Yeah, well, I would say that even though some of these numbers look daunting, and the rise in the share of long-term unemployed who are college educated is concerning, it is still the case that it's a relatively small number percentage-wise. You know, the percentage of college grads who are unemployed for longer than 6 months is still in the kind of 1 or 2% range overall. I mean, they're accounting for a bigger share of the long term of that smaller population. But you know, if you kind of pan out and say, like, if I get a college degree, am I likely to be unemployed? Am I likely to be unemployed for longer than 6 months? That's still pretty low. It's the trend lines that are concerning. So I think, you know, there are jobs out there, and the jobs tend to be good paying. We're a little worried about the direction things are headed, but for the moment, it's still a pretty good proposition.
Look at you leaving us on an optimistic note, Professor.
I've got one as well. Sure. I think there's three things I share with students. One is, when you're pursuing these opportunities, you really want to think about what is something that you're interested and passionate about. I think that does matter in terms of your happiness. Married against something that you're good at. That matters a lot, because you can be good at something, you can be passionate about it, but this third piece is the one that often students leave or don't remember as well. It has to be something that the market needs.
It's time to catch you up on the big stories of the day. We checked in with WBEZ news anchor Claire Lane and Nader Issa and John Seidel of the Sun-Times on everything from vaccine guidance to the Trump administration's stance on Illinois' assault weapons ban to the very latest on the fatal shooting of a suburban Chicago man by ICE. New reporting from the Sun-Times. This is on what happened in that fatal shooting of Silverio Villegas Gonzalez by an ICE agent. Now we've got this body cam footage from the local police in Franklin Park. What does that show?
Yeah, it really gives us a sort of scene of what it looked like immediately after the shooting. It's the officers who were responding. They're the first people on the scene. They're walking up. You see the ICE officers over the gentleman's body who they've shot after he was driving away. And you sort of hear these interactions right in the heat of the moment. And you hear that one of the ICE officers who was involved, he immediately says, "The man tried to drive into us." He's sort of immediately seeking to explain what happened. And then maybe the most interesting part that the video captures is that they both say that the ICE officers' agents were nothing major. And that's a pretty big deviation from what we heard from the Department of Homeland Security.
The injuries. Nothing major.
Right after the shooting, we got a statement from the Department of Homeland Security, from ICE, and they said that this officer was seriously injured. He was dragged a significant distance. He was hospitalized, but then his condition stabilized. Mm-hmm. And so this is a sort of inside look at what happened as far as the injuries go.
Right. Yeah. He says on camera, too, that he was, quote, dragged a little bit.
Yeah.
Interesting. What do we still not know, Nader, about the events of that day? That was September 12th.
Well, we still don't have a clear image of what happened to the officer who was injured. We've seen social media videos of, you know, the other side of the car, the officer who was not allegedly dragged. We see him sort of stepping away, but we don't actually see what happens to the officer on the other side. And so that's something that, you know, videos, surveillance videos, we're hoping to still get a sense of as we keep reporting.
You know, John, as someone who has to listen to a lot of testimony in federal court, I wonder what goes through your mind when you hear things like this, competing narratives about what happened in a fatal shooting.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, what does the evidence show, right? I mean, evidence like this body cam footage that we now have, and really the totality of the evidence, too. Nader mentioned that there's still other pieces of evidence that we don't have. But of course, you know, and I've seen this in lots of trials. I mean, there are people who will take the stand with lots of credibility issues, but if they're corroborated by the evidence, then that becomes powerful. So I think we'd be looking at exactly what Nader and our colleagues are looking at. What is the evidence? What does the video show about what happened?
Yeah. A lot of people were, I think, holding on with bated breath to see what this video would show, because I feel like a lot of folks were questioning the ICE agents, you know, their version of events from the start, wouldn't you say, Nader?
Yeah, there has been doubt cast, and, you know, we're in this environment right now. Things are very tense. People are going to doubt when something happens, but there also is a bit of a track record of statements that come out that don't exactly match fact. The other thing that, you know, the body camera footage shows is the truck driver. If we remember, the gentleman who was killed, his car crashed into the semi-truck.
That's right.
And the driver is on video being interviewed by local police officers at the scene. And he's sort of saying, you know, he thinks they shot him and then he crashed. He didn't really mention anything about an officer being dragged. So it's just another piece of information of what happened that day.
Claire, in other news, President Trump is spreading misinformation about vaccines. Now, yesterday this happened, and now Illinois medical officials, they're on a powerful panel and recommending that our state formally just part ways with the federal government. What's going on?
So there are a few things going on. The CDC no longer recommending the COVID-19 vaccine for everybody, essentially leaving it up to individuals and not requiring a prescription. So this influential committee, this is the Illinois Department of Public Health's Immunization Advisory Committee, and they essentially voted to part ways with the federal government regarding COVID-19 vaccines. And they're recommending that COVID shots are available and recommending that all adults and many children get them. Mm-hmm. So then additionally, the Trump administration announced yesterday that the FDA, this is sort of on the health front, will be updating drug labeling to discourage the use of acetaminophen by pregnant women, suggesting that there is a link between the painkiller Tylenol and autism. Already seeing local reaction from that, the Itasca-based American Academy of Pediatrics is saying that that conference, this statement, is filled with very dangerous claims, misleading information, and the health group is saying there is no single root cause of autism, including Tylenol or childhood vaccines.
My jaw dropped when I saw that headline yesterday. I don't know how where you all were when that news came across, but how can you go up there and just make things up? I feel like I ask this question every 3 weeks on the program when it involves our president. Tying Tylenol to autism, I mean, as the stepmother of an autistic boy, I'm just appalled that this is even in discussion right now. John?
You know, I kind of defer to you. I feel like this isn't really my area of expertise. I just think this muddies the waters and causes more chaos mm-hmm. and causes more frustration like you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
In other news, though, John, this is about clashes between the state and the federal government. The Trump administration's targeting Illinois' assault weapons ban. This mm-hmm. is right up your alley, so give us the details.
Right. Yeah, so the Trump administration, which is not actually a party to litigation over the assault weapons ban that Governor Pritzker signed in early 2023, has kind of been allowed to intervene in the appeal that went to the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals this week and participate. And what they're arguing is that states like Illinois are treating gun rights as second-class rights, and they want to treat them actually as civil rights. And so that's why they are getting involved here and participating in these arguments.
I understand Assistant Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon was actually here in Chicago making the arguments.
Right, yeah. So this is the top civil rights official in the country in the Trump administration, and she did. She came all the way to Chicago to participate in these arguments about the ban. The arguments lasted for about 90 minutes. She only spoke for about 5.
Oh, okay.
Right? So this is, in a way, this is just kind of symbolic, showing that they believe this litigation is important. There's been talk about it going to the Supreme Court. And she came in to make her case to the judges, who, by the way, help oversee courts, not just in Illinois, but in Indiana and Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I guess in most of it, she's dismissing the argument, basically, that the banned firearms are primarily suited for military use rather than personal defense.
Right. So the Seventh Circuit has considered this law before. There were arguments back in 2023, and they found that, you know, there's kind of this two-part test that the Supreme Court has set up to look at gun laws. It, you know, is whatever activity we're talking about covered by the Second Amendment? And then you have to mm-hmm. look at the historic tradition in the country. The Seventh Circuit found that these weapons like AR-15s, they don't even get Second Amendment rights because they are more like military grade weapons. That's what the court ruled. And so, yeah, she came in and she told the judge, including, you know, one judge who had joined in that opinion, that the position of the United States is they got it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's remember this all came from the, in response to the 2022 Highland Park mass shooting, right? Governor Pritzker signed the Illinois gun ban into law back then?
Exactly right, yeah. So that shooting where I believe it left 7 dead, the shooter used an AR-15 style rifle in that shooting. And so this was correct, a direct response to what happened in Highland Park.
Plenty of other news happening this morning, Claire. What is on your radar?
Well, we've got some feel-good stories. The all-boys choir from Chicago's Leo Catholic High School
yes.
has reached sort of the pinnacle of competing on the NBC show America's Got Talent. They are in the final.
Amazing.
And this is going to be tonight. So if they win, the prize is $1 million. They say they're going to spend it on college. Love to hear that.
Oh, man.
And also good vibes for doggy owners. Chicago Alderman Sometimes there's reporting, this is Timmy Knudsen, proposing to lift the ban of dogs at Chicago restaurants. Apparently, restaurants are prohibited from serving patrons accompanied by dogs, both inside and outside, unless it's a service dog. That depends on where you are.
I don't know how I feel about that.
He wants to let the dogs dine.
With me at the same time?
With you.
In the restaurant?
In the restaurant. We'll see.
Nader?
No comment.
You looked like you wanted to say something.
No, I love dogs, and we have one, but I don't want them when I'm eating, because they tend to beg, and they tend to really
yes,
get on your nerves
that.
When you're eating.
There's that for sure. While you're in the hot seat, Nader, let's get back to immigration for a few moments here. You've been doing some work here, keeping an eye on how federal enforcement and the so-called Midway Blitz is progressing. So we talked a moment ago about, you know, competing narratives and what that could do. But federal officials are saying that there have been hundreds of arrests and that they're arresting the, quote, worst of the worst. Is that accurate?
Well, some of my colleagues, like John, like Tom Shuba, our colleague Sophie Sherry, they've looked at this. The names that ICE officials are putting out that they're saying they're being arrested, this is, you know, their criminal background.
Mm-hmm.
They've looked into all this. And, you know, a lot of the arrests that ICE is touting happened out of state is what the Sun-Times found. A lot of people, though, do have violent criminal histories or they've previously been deported and returned to the United States. But we aren't getting a full picture. The Department of Homeland Security told the Associated Press they've made about 550 arrests this month as part of this deportation campaign, but they're not releasing data to back that up. They're just sort of sending this list of names. John, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of our conversation about what happened on September 12th, right?
Yeah.
And some of the statements from Homeland Security. I mean, it's, some of this is just subjective or exaggerated terminology. It comes to mind, there was one case I looked at who has been labeled the worst of the worst by Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was actually part of this enforcement effort. But, you know, when you look into the history of this person did have an attempted murder conviction back in the 80s.
Okay.
And since then served his time and, you know, came to Chicago and had a family and raised children and has been working and then kind of got caught up, picked up by ICE agents. And they labeled him the worst of the worst. I mean, he had a serious felony in his background, no mm-hmm. doubt about it. But it was some time ago and he reformed. I mean, his attorney told me this is what you want people to do is reform and go on and live productive lives.
Right. Yeah. Well, so just while I have the two of you here, I mean, what are you going to watch as you continue to follow this story, Nader?
Well, things have sort of started to heat up a little bit over the past week and a half, 2 weeks. You know, we started with ICE officers picking people up like that flower vendor in a parking lot. And then we've seen traffic stops across the suburbs in the city. We more recently saw that big raid in Elgin mm-hmm. early morning. They busted the doors down. And now at the Broadview facility in the western suburbs, you know, ICE and Border Patrol have been shooting people with pepper balls and tear gas, and things are just heating up. And the president has made these on and off threats to send the National Guard. All of this has sort of followed a similar playbook to what happened in LA. And we just want to see where this goes because it's really unclear when this campaign is going to end, if it's going to escalate, if it's going to scale back, and just where it goes
from here. Following
the
footsteps of what happened in LA, I feel like that was the goal, right? And that was kind of what they told us they were going to do.
Yeah, there was this like sort of rush of enforcement. We saw these videos of federal agents rushing out of the back of vans and scattering people in the mm-hmm. Home Depot parking lot or in parks. They had, you know, and so it is what we saw. It seemed a little bit more heightened in LA and it drew out a reaction. There were protests and the local authorities there sort of tried to stamp those out. And then that's what gave the excuse for the federal officials to send the National Guard in.
Yeah. Well, leave us with this, John. Next steps in the Trump administration's arguments against our state's assault weapons ban. I mean, could this go all the way to the Supreme Court?
It very well could. And we've had multiple justices at the Supreme Court show interest in taking up a case like this.
When?
And specifically Illinois. Well, first we got, so the Seventh Circuit, these three judges heard this argument yesterday.
Yeah.
Now they got a rule. And we have no idea when that's going to happen. So that ruling will come down. I think particularly if they side with Pritzker, I think we'll definitely see yet another petition to the Supreme Court. And again, even Justice Clarence Thomas specifically has shown an interest in taking this one up.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Maha Ahmed, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you just heard, we hope you join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays. And once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening and have a great day.